This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Dante's Divine Comedy, Part 1. The lecturers are Professors William Cook and Ronald Hertzman of the State University of New York at Geneseo. Professor William Cook is a distinguished teaching professor of history at SUNY Geneseo, where he has taught for over 30 years. He received his bachelor's degree cum laude at Wabash College and his PhD from Cornell University. Professor Cook teaches courses in medieval and ancient history. Professor Ronald Hertzman is a distinguished teaching professor of English at SUNY Geneseo. He graduated with honors from Manhattan College and received his master's and PhD in English literature from the University of Delaware. Professor Hertzman's teaching interests, in addition to Dante, include Francis of Assisi, Chaucer, Shakespeare, the Bible, and Arthurian literature. He is also a recipient of the Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching. Professors Cook and Hertzman have been collaborating intensively since 1973. Both prolific writers in their own right, together, they have published The Medieval Worldview with the Oxford University Press and are currently at work on a second edition. Another collaboration for the teaching company resulted in the course Francis of Assisi. Professors Cook and Hertzman prepared the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, Reading the Poem, Issues and Editions.
In this first lecture, we thought we would introduce you to Dante and to his wonderful poem, The Divine Comedy. First, I guess, by talking just a little bit about the kind of literary achievement that it is, and then maybe say a little bit about the way in which one approaches the poem, given that we'll be reading it in translation, and finally end with a little bit about Dante's life and times. To begin, I think it's pretty clear to pretty much everyone that this is a remarkable, indeed unmatched, literary achievement in many ways. Dante takes as his subject nothing less than a journey to the three parts of the Christian afterlife, to hell and to purgatory and to heaven. And given that huge scope, pretty much anything is fair game in terms of subject matter for his readers to contemplate, because he brings in such an enormous amount, both in terms of subject matter and also in terms of dealing with the sorts of concerns that not only would be important to anybody alive on the planet in the 14th century, but also to anybody alive on the planet in our time as well.
Let me give you an example. A few years ago, Ron and I had the opportunity to teach Dante's Divine Comedy, or Commedia, in a maximum security prison. And we had just begun, and we were talking about one of the first sinners in hell. And an inmate put up his hand and said, "That's me. That's why I'm here. I did what she's doing right here in this poem." And I think in a way that for academics perhaps hit it harder than ever before, is the fact that this poem is really of universal significance and of contemporary value. Anybody who reads the poem seriously is going to confront him or herself issues of our day as well as Dante's day, because although obviously we need some historical background and we know that Dante's original audience is different than ourselves in many ways, nevertheless, the universality of Dante's concerns, the extraordinary breadth of what he has to say, mean that this poem really can work on us every bit as much as it worked on somebody living in Dante's own time.
Yeah, let me piggyback on what Bill said by giving another specific instance here. Like everybody else, Dante scholars were anxious to jump on the millennium craze, and they had a millennium conference, and all the advertisements went out and said, this is your once-in-a-thousand-year-lifetime opportunity to sort of talk about Dante. They even had a slogan, and the slogan was, when we get to the 21st century, we'll find that Dante is there waiting for us. And corny as it sounded, it seemed to me it was not only effective but accurate, because the sorts of concerns that are in the poem are the sorts of concerns that are of as much interest to people in the 21st century. So that, for example, it is a poem that deals with the way in which we have to wrestle with political institutions. How are we to be governed? What is justice and what is injustice? It deals with the idea of spiritual transformation. It deals with issues like, what are good reasons for writing a poem and what are good reasons for reading a poem? So the really big issues that folks have wrestled with turn out to be central to the Commedia, and what we want to do is try and give you the best possible entryway into those particular issues.
If you will, just as Virgil and later others are Dante's guide, the purpose of a guide is, of course, to, in a sense, make him or herself irrelevant. That's our goal, too. If we're your guides through this particular reading of Inferno and Purgatorio and Paradiso, what we hope is that you will go back to the poem many times and you'll find that perhaps memories of your guide are valuable, but you're now really ready to proceed on your own.
And so to start, let's talk just a little bit about what makes the poem so complex. First thing, of course, is that it's very long. It's 14,000 lines long. And as we said, divided into three parts. And each of those three parts is further subdivided. Dante invents a term, or at least gives a new meaning to the term canto, simply means a song. And they become the sort of chapter divisions of each of the three parts of the poem, and indeed of the poem as a whole. So there are 34 cantos in the Inferno, 33 in the Purgatorio, and 33 in the Paradiso. Again, the grand total of 100. Each of those 100 cantos itself a complex piece of work, and further subdivided according to another ingenious scheme that Dante develops, a particular way of rhyming things, a particular way of having a kind of small stanza, which Dante calls terza rima. What would that be, third rhyme or triple rhyme?
Exactly. And so every canto has a number of these tercets, as we call them, this group of three lines. They average about 140 lines per canto. Nevertheless, some are shorter, some are longer. But the rhyme scheme is extraordinarily important if you're going to understand the beauty of the language of the poem. To put it in the simplest terms, it's A, B, A, B, C, B. In other words, the first and third lines of one tercet rhyme with the second line of the next tercet, and then those first and third lines interlock with the middle line of the next tercet, and so on. So it's an extraordinarily complex rhyme scheme, a lot easier to do, we might add, in Italian than it would be in other languages. Oh, for example, English would come to mind.
Yeah, so what that means, of course, is that anybody dealing with it in a modern English translation is going to be faced with a very difficult problem. How do you handle the rhyme? Again, to take what Bill said and put it into another way of looking at it, every word in Italian, or almost every word, ends in a vowel, which means that if you're rhyming, then what you can do is take any word and say, well, one word out of six is going to rhyme with it, all right? If you're doing that in English, you've got many more opportunities to have the rhyme, and therefore rhyme itself is a much more difficult thing to accomplish. So the question is, What do you do if you're taking the poem from Italian and trying to put it into English? We want to say just a little bit about what some of the various modern translators have done in their attempt to deal with this issue and the problem of translation in general, so that right from the beginning you can have a sense of how best to follow along in the poem yourself. The first thing that I would say about the question of translation is this, that if you were to take any five Dante scholars and put them in a room and say, what is the best translation for somebody coming to the poem for the first time in English, you would get six different answers. Okay? And the reason for that is not simply that Dante scholars are a cranky lot and don't want to agree with each other. It's that there are so many different variables that you have to play off, that what one considers important might not be what is considered most important by the next. Let's take that question of rhyme. In our time, there has been one serious attempt to imitate Dante's terza rima in English. And while you can kind of admire it, I'm not sure that that's where you'd want to go for your first time or even your second or even your third time through the poem. Because as it turns out, to get things to rhyme, you have to do a little bit of forcing with the language, and it sounds very stilted. Indeed, what it does is it sounds a bit forced. So most of those who have decided to translate Dante into English will try to give some kind of sense of what the poetic line looks like. In other words, keep those little three-line stanzas, but not really rhyme, or at least not really continue the rhyme through the intricate pattern that Bill has established.
Not all, by the way, do that. There are purely prose translations of the Divine Comedy. And supposedly the advantage to them is, because they don't have to worry at all about setting things up as a poem, they can be the most literal and the most straightforward and not have to worry about any of the artistry of the poem at all. And although there is some value in reading a prose translation, perhaps for that reason. And, you know, I remember when a couple of my kids were in school, somehow or other poetry really put them off, but they would read a prose translation of Homer, for example. Maybe there are some people for whom a purely prose translation is valuable, but certainly most of the translations we have today, and the one we're going to use and the others we're going to talk about, are indeed ones that try to keep some sense of the poem as poem.
Yeah. Now, one of the exceptions to that turns out to be when people realize the limitations of prose, as Bill said, but also say, look, what you've got is a poem in Italian. Why not have Italian on one page? And then if you're going to use the other page, a prose translation might be good as long as you go over to the other side from time to time. And I think that this was intended not only for people who have some grasp of Italian, but people who have studied any of the related languages. So that if you've done a little bit of Latin, a little bit of French, a little bit of Spanish, it would be possible to glance over at the Italian side and take a look at the English translation. In those cases, the prose might be a help, although again, this is not the only way that it's done. Simply to say that there are a ton of options out there to choose from. Another problem with modern translation is that, as you can imagine, it's an enormous undertaking to translate a 14,000-line poem. And folks get started and publish their Inferno and say the other volumes are forthcoming, but they don't always come forth quite that quickly. And so there are a number of new translations that just came out, really terrific, but we don't know what the rest of it is going to be. So that, just to give two examples, in the last couple of years, both Robert Hollander and Robert Durling and his partner Martinez have come out with translations of the Inferno, but that's all we have. And again, to our reckoning, these are both very good, facing page, dual language with neat notes, but if you want to read the whole poem, they're not particularly valuable, although it does raise a very interesting question about, again, do you need to take the whole thing from one translation, or can you read one Inferno, another Purgatory, another Paradise?
And obviously there are arguments for both ways. If you read the same translation all the way through, you become very comfortable with the language. It flows as a poem beginning in the dark wood of error and ending with Dante meeting God face to face. If you use different translations, obviously you have to readjust as you pick up each translation, as each translator used somewhat different principles or somewhat different degree of literalness or whatever. On the other hand, perhaps comprehensively after reading three different translations, you have a better sense of Dante as a whole because each one can only draw some of the things that Dante does with his own original language of Italian.
All that being said, what would we recommend in terms of a kind of relatively cheap, relatively accessible translation? For a long time, John Ciardi's translations have been much used, and he has a poet's sensibility, and his notes are okay, although not terrific. And so that would be one option. Another, Alan Mandelbaum, very nice because cheap paperback edition. He's got on one side the Italian, on the other his own translation. Problem with Mandelbaum, his notes aren't all that great. For English-speaking readers, the translation that is sort of standard is that of Charles Singleton. But the reason for that has a lot more to do with the fact that Singleton provides prodigious notes for the entire Commedia. So that, for example, what you get, if you want to shell out the $130 or so that it costs for the Singleton edition, three volumes of text and translation, three much, much thicker volumes of notes. And while those notes are wonderful for the scholar, it might not be the most useful edition for the non-scholar. The notes can be a little bit overwhelming, maybe a little bit intimidating.
And sometimes those notes are of value only if you're studying Dante in the original Italian. In other words, it'll talk about how Dante used this word variation rather than that word variation. And therefore, those who are looking for the notes that help to provide the background to understand the poem find themselves skimming through some notes to find the ones that really get to the heart of what they want notes for. And so, although, again, it's a great reference, it may not be the best thing to use your first time through for a reading where you want notes that give you the background to make the stories that Dante tells intelligible.
All of that having been said, we can now sort of talk about the translation that we're going to use here and that we're going to be quoting from, Mark Muse's three-volume edition and translation of the Divine Comedy. Again, with all of what we've said, so it's clear we're not forcing this on you or saying that this is necessarily the best, but given the options, it's the one that we use with our undergraduates in class, and there are two good reasons for it. One, I think that he does a pretty reasonable job in the translation itself, and also he sustains it throughout. My own impression is that as a translator, he gets better as he gets rolling, and that I think he does a very good job, for example, with the Paradiso, which is the hardest, I think, of the three canticles to translate. The other thing is that Muse, it seems to us at any rate, has the best notes for somebody who is coming to the poem for the first time. That is to say, notes that are fairly comprehensive will tell you most of what you need to know, but not intimidating and not overwhelming. And they don't assume that you've been reading the poem for a long time. Nothing particularly technical about what he does in the notes.
There's also a good introductory essay. And as in many translations, there are also things like diagrams of the various parts of the afterlife and a very useful glossary at the back of each volume. So if you want to find a character or a geographical place that Dante mentions, you don't have to skim back through all the notes, and it's not really an index. It really is a glossary that's very, very handy in looking up things very quickly.
Now, again, a lot of what we've said about edition leads to something else about the poem, which gives it a kind of unique status. We've been talking about the notes, and I guess we need to say something about why one needs notes. Why in most editions, certainly Muse's included, the notes are almost as long and in some cases longer than the text itself. This is sort of tricky business because it makes it seem as though the poem is totally inaccessible unless you're willing to do an awful lot of work outside of the poem. I think we probably should say at the outset that if somebody wanted to go through the poem, reading it and not look at a single note, you would get an awful lot out of it. Dante does a number of things that make the poem accessible to the first-time reader, most of all because he's such a good storyteller, that this journey that a pilgrim named Dante takes to the three parts of the afterworld is a action-packed adventure story. And if you wanted to get it on no other level, you could do that. But most readers, and I think for good reasons, also see the necessity for notes, and that necessity was seen even in Dante's own time. In other words, you can get something, but there's more, and the notes are an aid to that more.
The commentary tradition on the Divine Comedy began practically before the ink was dry on the 100th canto. In fact, one of the first commentators on Dante's poem was one of his sons. And unlike almost any other of the world's literature except the Bible, the tradition has been handed down now for almost 700 years of people doing line-by-line commentaries. You can find it on the web. You can find it in many, many learned volumes, that every line has its commentators so that one could do what scholars did in the Middle Ages for the Bible, and that is to say comment on every single verse. Obviously, again, these notes are a much watered-down version of this tradition. But why do we need them at all, I think, is the question Ron raised. Let me just suggest one way of answering that question. First of all, in general, when we read old books, the thing that strikes us is that we're not the intended audience, and that therefore the original audience knew things that we just don't know. And in a sense, the commentary, the notes, the footnotes, are to sort of bring us up to snuff with Dante's original audience, or Homer's original audience, or Plato's original audience, or whatever. The reason it's so much more complex for Dante than almost any other of the great world authors is that in his journey through the afterlife, he just runs into so many folks and chats with them, and they tell, sometimes straightforwardly, sometimes not, their own stories. And Dante expects his audience to have some general familiarity, if not with every character, at least the context out of which those characters came. That is to say, their political milieu, their social milieu, and whatever. And when almost all of the stories in the Commedia are Dante chatting with folks that he meets, not to know who many of those folks are, after a while, sort of becomes a burden to us, and there's the danger of sort of losing track of the story simply because here's another name I don't know followed by another name I don't know, and I can't tell whether this guy's telling his story straight or not because I never heard of this guy.
Let me piggyback on that for a minute also. Bill has said that what you get is Dante encountering all these interesting figures whom he talks with in all three parts of the poem. Well, we need to know something about those three figures in the three parts of the poem. We also need to know something about Dante himself, because the poet takes the very unusual and really daring move of making himself the hero of this poem. In other words, the person who encounters all of this is a guy named Dante, and helpful to access the poem is therefore something of an understanding of who Dante is and what his own life was about. In other words, the kind of biographical stuff surrounding Dante that we know as it's present in the poem and as it's present in the commentary tradition about the poem is not some kind of window dressing. Gee, it would be nice to know something about the author. I wish we knew about Homer in the way that we know about Dante. I wish we knew more about Shakespeare. But rather, what's going on here is that since he is the hero of his poem, and since he sets the poem halfway through his own life, we need to know as much as we can about that life, especially that first half, the first 35 years of it.
Let me give an illustration. Dante, of course, is from the city of Florence. There are an awful lot of famous Florentines. Machiavelli, Michelangelo, and whatever. And if you go to Florence today and walk around the city, you can visit, obviously, statues of Michelangelo in museums. You can visit Michelangelo's house. You can see the tomb of Machiavelli. But wherever you go in Florence, you see Dante. Because what's happened is when Dante refers in his poem to a specific place in Florence, they'll tack up those lines in Italian on that building so that as you walk around Florence, you realize how deeply rooted in this city as well as in areas beyond the actual city limits. This poem is, you can't go two blocks in Dante's Florence, not quite as big as today's Florence, you can't go two blocks without finding a couple lines here and a couple lines there, because the poem is so deeply rooted in his physical world, his own personal, political, social, cultural experiences as a citizen of this late medieval city.
So let's talk just a little bit about Dante. It connects so importantly with the city of Florence, and that's a really good place to begin by saying simply that Dante was born in Florence in the year 1265, and that his family came from the merchant class of that city.
The city of Florence at that time probably had about 100,000 citizens. It was very, very tightly packed together. An area smaller than today's Florence, in fact, because you had to put up walls for medieval cities, and walls are expensive, and therefore the smaller they are, the less it costs to defend the place. So Dante was born in a hustling, bustling, international, mercantile-centered city. It doesn't look a lot today like it looked in Dante's day. The buildings that dominate the skyline today, the Cathedral of Florence and the City Hall, were in fact begun about the time that Dante left Florence for the last time. There certainly are some things that Dante was in. The building he was baptized in, for example, the Baptistry of Florence, is in the earliest depictions of the city that we have. We don't even know how old that building is. So Dante grew up in a merchant family, in a time that was economically prosperous, but politically tumultuous. And as Dante, the young man, grew up, and we know almost nothing about his early years, it seems that he developed two great passions. He was interested, passionately interested, and deeply involved in politics. And young Dante, turns out, was also, surprise, surprise, a poet.
So that what we have is, in his life before he sets about writing the Divine Comedy, records of what his political life was like. Fortunately, Dante was pretty successful as politician and statesman as he grew up, but we also, of course, have records of his life as a poet. In particular, if you wanted to look at sort of the climax of this career, this youthful career as a poet, he wrote a work called the Vita Nuova, The New Life, which is a very interesting collection of love poems that he wrote to a woman named Beatrice, and put them together as a kind of complete volume, a volume that somehow, through the poems, was meant to construct a kind of poetic autobiography. And in order to do that, what he did was to take the poems and then analyze them himself, giving a kind of commentary from his own life. And this work turns out to be an early masterpiece, which is of the magnitude that would be studied as an important work of an Italian literature, of world literature, had Dante never written the Commedia. But more important for our purposes is that the subject, other than Dante himself, of course, is this woman whom he falls in love with, a woman named Beatrice. And the fact is that Beatrice becomes a very important character in the Commedia. Indeed, she becomes one of Dante's guides later on. So, as poet, he turns out to have had a very successful career before the Commedia, but the kind of stuff that he does, love poetry in particular, becomes important when we see the transition from the Vita Nuova to the Commedia.
Similarly, Dante had some real success politically. Florence didn't have what we would call a strong executive government, but rather every 2 months they changed officials. And there were six officials who served two-month terms called priors, and they were sort of the titular head committee of Florence for those 2 months. And at the age of 35, in the year 1300, Dante became one of those priors for 2 months, between June and August of 1300. He had really hit the big time. And even after those 2 months, he served important ambassadorial jobs, as he had also before he served as prior. So Dante was a very successful political figure. But Florence was a deeply, deeply factionalized city. We'll talk more about the details of that in the next lecture. And ultimately, the factionalism reached ahead And in 1301, when Dante was in fact away from Florence in Rome, his party, his faction, got kicked out, and Dante never returned to Florence. He was born there in 1265. He left for the last time in 1301. He lives the next 20 years of his life as an exile from his homeland.
Now, notice that this is sort of interesting in terms of what we've already said about the year 1300, the year in which the poem is set. Dante takes the journey in 1300 at a time when in his real life he is at the height of his success, okay? A prior in the city of Florence, a successful poet. And yet, he's writing the poem at a time when all of that success has gone down the tubes. He's writing the poem as an exile, and as an exile who really has no hope of returning to Florence. He spends the last 19 years of his life in that exile, and the fact is that he probably completes the poem only very shortly before his death. And so what we have is this paradox of the poem with Florence in some ways as its center being written by somebody who is far away from Florence, wandering as an exile and unable to come back to Florence.
And where did he go? Well, we know some parts of the answer to that question. For a while, he stayed with his faction as they tried to overthrow the folks who had overthrown them. It seems probably only in 1304 he gave that up. And then we know he went to live in a variety of places, the most important of which was the city of Verona in the north, your basic Romeo and Juliet town. And while in Verona, it seems, he did a good deal of the writing of the Commedia. And then toward the end of his life, he moved to the city of Ravenna on the Adriatic coast. There he died. We actually have his death mask. It's in Florence. We can see what he looked like when he died. And there in Ravenna, he is buried in a little chapel attached to the Franciscan church in Ravenna. And despite the fact that the Florentines in modern times have wanted his body back and made a splendid tomb for him in Florence, he's in Ravenna.
In fact, one of the ways that it's really kind of nifty to think about the poem is to think about the two tombs, the splendid one in Florence that doesn't have anybody in it, and the one in Ravenna, kind of grubby, out of the way, a nice sign over it, you know, sort of the tomb of Dante the poet, but the very lack of grandeur of that tomb is a very nice statement, I think, about this as a poem of exile, something that we'll be coming back to over and over again in our talk, the notion that it could not have been written except as a poem of exile and has to be understood as a poem of exile.
And so as we move to the next lecture, we need to take up some of that political stuff that was responsible for his exile and also begin to talk about how Dante makes this extraordinary poem.
Lecture 2, A Poet and His City, Dante's Florence.
As we said in the last lecture, much of the Commedia involves Dante traveling through the afterlife, meeting up with a whole bunch of folks, many of whom, most of us, even those who are scholars, really don't know from their study of the past. And therefore, what we want to do today is to begin to help with the understanding of the peopling of Dante's afterlife. We want to set up the rules of the game to a great extent, and then begin to talk about especially the political background, because especially in Inferno, but really throughout the entire poem, Dante is going to be making political commentary through not only his own mouth and the mouth of Virgil and his other guides, but also through the mouths of so many of these folks whom he runs into.
One way of getting at this issue is to go to a question that I usually ask my students when we begin looking at Dante. The question is simply this: what do you need to get your membership card in Dante's afterlife? And I usually ask the question, and somebody puts up a hand and says, you need to be dead. And I say, that's the right answer. What's the second part? And usually somebody else says, you need to be dead by 1300, which is, of course, as we said in the last lecture, the actual date of the journey from the point of view of the pilgrim. Now, it's interesting if you think about this. First of all, it allows Dante the poet to have an enormous scope here in terms of who the pilgrim is going to encounter. Because what it means is that, well, this includes folks who died in 1299. It also includes Adam and Eve. Actually, Adam and Eve will show up as characters in the Paradiso. It also includes everybody in between. Now, notice that that means everybody. Dante does not distinguish between what we would think of as real people, historical characters who actually lived, and folks who come from books, characters in books. So that, for example, we get to see Aeneas. He's a character, even though he was a creation of Virgil, who also turns out to be a character there. So, dead by 1300, real or fictional. Now, the thing is that a lot of those folks are very famous. A lot of those folks are famous in our time as well as in Dante's time. You've got people from the Bible who played a prominent role, and all kinds of political figures who have made a very big impact on world history. And all of those folks turn out to be people that we know something about, but maybe would like to know a little bit more. So commentaries are certainly necessary for them. But even more important, what we need to do is talk about the figures who are dead by 1300, who are folks who lived in Dante's Florence or in any of the neighboring cities, and whose fame really was a kind of local fame. In other words, folks who would have been pretty well known in Dante's time and place, but not well known at all, maybe not even known at all in our own time. So a good bit of what we're going to be doing now is to try and bridge that gap by talking about the scene that Dante grew up in.
Let's remember also that if Dante wants to talk about politics and other facets of Florentine life and Italian life around 1300, he by and large cannot use his own contemporaries directly to do that, because Dante is 35 years old in 1300, and therefore most of his colleagues and friends and contemporaries, his political buddies and his political enemies, are still alive. That to look at contemporary politics, Dante will sometimes indeed go way back into ancient history. We'll meet Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar and the Emperor Trajan, for example. But more often, he tends to go back, if you will, one generation, the generation of his parents and perhaps his grandparents. And there's a good reason for that. One is most of them are dead, and therefore they fit the rule. But the second thing is that these are the stories that Dante himself grew up with. Now, Ron and I were both born in the same year. We were born toward the end of World War II. So we don't remember World War II or another event in our parents' lives, the Depression. But boy, did we grow up hearing the stories about it. There are times when you sort of have to remember, you know, I only know this stuff because of other people telling me the stories. I really wasn't around during the Depression. I wasn't really around and functioning during World War II. And that's what Dante is going to do. We're going to have an awful lot of folks populate Dante's afterlife that have died pretty recently, because not only are they people that are still remembered by Dante's audience, but he can use them and the stories he knows about them not only to talk about a little bit of recent history, but in many ways, symbolically anyway, to talk about the present, to talk about what's going on right here, right now. Different cast of characters, sometimes different labels on the political factions, but the basic problems have not changed very much since the generation before Dante and his contemporaries.
So we're going to start with that generation, and even though Dante himself will not limit himself to talking about Florence, Florence certainly is the center and certainly the focus. So Before we talk about some people, we'll talk about where they lived. What kind of a place was Florence in the generation before Dante?
As we said in the last lecture, it was a busy, bustling, high population, high density city surrounded by walls. And that means life is lived largely outdoors. It means that people knew each other's faces, they knew each other's business, they knew lots of personal things about them. After all, housing didn't have lights and heat and a lot of other things. And even today, when one is in Italy, one finds that there are times a day when people just go out and stroll to be seen. So it was a life lived much more publicly, much less privately. And therefore, if we're going to talk about the politics of Dante's Florence, that's where we have to start. That is to say, if you ask the question, who doesn't like whom? There are a lot of ways to approach that. We can approach it, for example, as socially. That is to say, those who were parts of the old rural aristocracy had moved in don't like the nouveau riche. And that's a very important problem in Florence, for example. But a lot of times, the people you don't like, and this takes on political ramifications in Florence, are your neighbors, somebody who insulted you, somebody who insulted your sister, somebody who threw garbage around your house. And we know that a lot of the quarrels began with very personal things, and there's a very personal side to Florentine politics. The story that both Dante and contemporary chroniclers tell of the beginning of factionalism in Florence goes back to a guy who snubbed a woman he was supposed to marry when he got a better offer. And that perhaps is literally true. It happened in 1215. But much more important, it is symbolically true. And we never want to forget the sort of visceral, gut, local side of Florentine politics. And that will come out over and over and over when Dante meets Florentines, again, largely of the previous generation.
Remind ourselves that 1215 story. First of all, it turns out Dante uses it in the Commedia itself. But, you know, we think about it, okay, person was snubbed, and so, well, let's not talk to them for a while. I was going to marry her, but they gave me a better offer. I'll marry the other one instead. Well, no, that's not how it ended. It ended with a lot of people, starting with the bridegroom, being killed, and an awful lot of straight-out hardcore violence was the result of this, and that violence kind of continued. That if you look at 1215 as a starting point, it certainly had not diminished by the time that Dante sets the poem, and it certainly hadn't diminished in that generation immediately before the setting of the poem. So that we're talking about the existence of a lot of urban violence. People died in the streets. Okay, the stuff that you read about in Romeo and Juliet is sort of based on what was actually happening in the factionalistic struggles that were taking place in the cities of Italy.
Ron's exactly right. We need to think about a lot of violence, not always leading to death, but insults and all the rest that really did inflame people. And one of the reasons it got so testy and violent is because, needless to say, people, both those of the traditional aristocracy and the nouveau riche, wanted power. That's what you want. Political power. Be able to control the legal mechanisms, the judiciary, and other parts of the city as well. And, well, there are only so many offices to go around. And so, at least as one chronicler contemporary with Dante describes things, it was the competition for offices that made things so violent, so visceral, so constantly factional, that there were always these fights because if these folks held office, then these folks didn't. And if these folks hold office, they can use that for their advantage to install themselves, ideally, in perpetuity in office. So there is a great deal of competition for power, only so many titles, only so many jobs to go around. But this is only the beginning of understanding Florentine politics. As I said, there are also social distinctions. There are economic distinctions which don't always fit the social categories. you get, again, some very wealthy merchants who don't come from very important families. And of course, they have money which they can use to gain power over the traditional nobility. And these kinds of tensions are also very clear. We'll see people from that aristocracy, for example, snub Dante, even when Dante's looking in on them, oh, let's say, somewhere in the middle of hell. They'll still sort of say, but you're not from a very important family. You're not from a family that can be traced back as many generations as my family can be traced back. It's more complicated than that. Because in addition to what's going on inside the walls of Florence, Florence exists in a bigger world. For one thing, of course, Florence was an independent nation. Italy as a country only came along in the 19th century. And so Florence's independent neighbors, for example, are Arezzo and Siena and Pisa and Lucca and so forth. And these are independent countries too. And guess what? Independent countries fight. And they fight over many of the things that we would expect. They fight over, well, is that castle that's sort of in the border yours or mine? If we get this little piece, we have access to some more water that would flow into an area of our nation and so on. And so there's a great deal of regional fighting over exactly the kinds of things you would expect, over border lines, over water rights, over access to highways, and all that sort of stuff.
Now, notice that we started locally. We've moved out a little bit to the neighboring city-states. We can move out even more and talk about causes for factionalism and political dispute in the larger circumstances of European politics as a whole. Because even as there were all of these independent city-states in the part of Italy that Dante is from, there were also larger, I'm not sure world powers would be the best way of describing them, but at least larger European powers that also exhibited a lot of clout, not simply, let's say, in the case of the Holy Roman Emperor, one of those two powers, not simply in the territory where he had residence, but throughout Europe. And the other sort of political clout that was exercised in Europe as a whole and in Italy as a whole was with the Pope. So to start locally and move out, we now need to be a little bit more global in talking about the place of emperor and pope in the European political scene, and then sort of take it back locally and see how it affects Florence.
So Florence is a little nation in the whole European scheme, but a very important one because of its economic power and because of its geographical location. Well, there were, in the early Middle Ages, of course, the development of the papacy, the office of the Bishop of Rome, although it was much more a tradition than a government in the early Middle Ages. And there was a development of the Holy Roman Empire, beginning with Charlemagne in 800, rejuvenated by Otto the Great in the 10th century. But by and large, those officials and those powers were not in direct conflict. But beginning toward the end of the 11th century, they were in big-time conflict. And the ultimate question was, who rules the world? Pretty big question. That is to say, ultimately, when push comes to shove, obviously it's best if they work together, who really is first and foremost in charge? Who has the authority from God to rule in the world? And in the 13th century, the century in which Dante is born, that question took a particular political form that involves us thinking for a minute of a map of Italy. If you divide Italy as you go down the boot into three sections, it'll help. The top third, roughly, is a series of independent nations, of which Florence is one of the most important. The middle third, roughly, was controlled by the popes, not just as a spiritual center, but as their political territory. They had all the rights over the center part of Italy that any secular ruler had. And then the southern third was governed by a monarchy. It was a monarchy for a while of French, but it was a strong monarchy that included everything from, oh, say, a little bit north of Naples, including the island of Sicily. So this is a political scheme. What happens around 1220 is this. The guy who's the monarch of southern Italy and Sicily also gets elected Holy Roman Emperor. And in theory, the Holy Roman Emperor is sort of the lord over these northern Italian city-states. Not much in practice, but in theory. But this emperor and king, Frederick II, Frederick Hohenstaufen is his name, has an idea. I'd like to really get control of those northern Italian city-states. I'd like that to be not just in spirit, but in fact, my territory, and I'm already king of the South. Okay, you can picture what this does. It means the Pope has the same neighbor on the north and on the south. And as it turns out, Frederick was not a very friendly neighbor. And a knockdown, drag-out struggle began between the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire for control of Italy and, in some real ways, control to be numero uno in Europe at this time.
A couple of comments to make about that. First of all, keep this in mind because Frederick himself becomes a player in the Commedia. He's somebody that we will see later on. But notice what this does to the story that we started out with, the story in Florence. You now have two competing world powers, two competing ideologies, and you have these smaller city-states, Florence, for our purposes, chief among them. When the factionalism in Florence develops, okay, one side fighting against another, there's a kind of natural tendency to go to the big guys on the outside and seek support. Well, the folks who wanted to seek the support from the emperor were called Ghibellines. The folks who wanted to seek the support from the Pope were called Guelphs. And all of a sudden, in Florence, and in all of the city-states surrounding Florence, the struggles that were going on, sort of the umbrella term, struggle between Guelphs and Ghibellines, becomes a way of capturing something of what was going on, showing the linkage between what was going on in the city and what was going on in the larger theater of European and world politics.
So let's get specific for a second. Let's say you are part of a faction in Florence that's in the minority. What you will do then perhaps is go to one of those superpowers and say, hey, we'll be your guys in this territory. They really aren't interested in the ideology of Pope so much or the ideology of emperor. What they want is help. What they want to do is take over their own place. They want to be in charge. And since in Florence, the Ghibellines were traditionally the minority, they depended very heavily on sort of outsiders helping them out militarily and politically to try to get control of this place. And the time we're going to focus on is a time in 1260. Let me tell you how far this can go. Where the Ghibellines of Florence allied with the city of Siena, its southern neighbor, which was dominated by Ghibellines. And together, they fought the army of Florence, which at that time was dominated by Guelphs, at a very famous battle named Montaperti in 1260. The Ghibellines won, and therefore the Ghibellines took over Florence, even though Florence had more Guelphs than Ghibellines. They took over temporarily. It was during that six-year rule of the Ghibellines that a fellow named Dante was born in Florence in 1265. And when Dante's 1 year old, the Ghibellines are kicked out, and his party, the Guelphs, come back into power. You see what I mean? These are the stories that Dante grows up with. These are the stories of the struggle for control over Florence. It's not about papal and imperial ideology primarily, although the propaganda is used to fuel the hostilities. It's about, to a much greater extent, local control, local power, local seizing and control over offices.
Now, you would think Ghibellines are out, Guelphs take over. Well, jeepers, maybe some of this factionalism will now stop. Turns out that the Ghibellines never really came back into Florence as a powerful force. So you have Florence as a Guelph city, and it remains a Guelph city, and it remains a happy, contented city. Well, not hardly.
Not quite, because, well, this has happened before and has happened since in politics. If basically one party comes to dominate, guess what happens? Squabbles break out within the party over the same old issues, insults, social standing, and all the rest. And so in the 1290s, Dante's an adult by this time. In the 1290s, we begin to get real new factions developing, not between Guelphs and Ghibellines. Ghibellines are minor players by now, at least in Florence. We get divisions within the Guelph party, and it gets very bitter in the way that former friends who become enemies become very bitter. We call these two factions of the Guelphs the Whites and the Blacks, simply by sort of colors that identified them, sort of armbands, if you will. And so Dante gets caught up in factional politics, the next generation. And the next generation is within the Guelphs rather than between the Guelphs and Ghibellines. And so, since the Holy Roman Emperor at this time is pretty weak in terms of Italy, each faction goes to the strongest political power in Italy and says, you back us. And the strongest political faction in Italy was the papacy. And by 1294, the papacy was headed by a fella, again, we'll hear a lot about him in Dante, named Pope Boniface VIII.
Well, what happens, of course, is that they're both looking for the support from Boniface, the Whites and the Blacks, but Boniface is only going to give the support to one. And as it turns out, for a variety of reasons, Boniface supports the Black Guelphs rather than the White. He sends his troops to expel the Whites, and it turns out that that is the direct cause of Dante's own exile. The circumstances are kind of interesting, and it's worth us saying a little bit more about it because Boniface, too, is really a major player, a really important character in Inferno and mentioned throughout the whole Commedia. So a little bit more here might seem to be just a little bit more detail than you would want at this point. Trust us, it's going to be important as it goes on. A little bit more about Boniface and his relationship to the struggles in Florence is necessary.
It's first of all important to say that Boniface was himself a native of a town near Rome. He actually was a native of the Papal States. And becoming the Pope meant that he was involved in the governance of central Italy, the Papal States. And guess what? There are factions there too. Different families. And his family had been in and out of power as popes in the 13th century, and they had terrible, terrible and vicious enemies among other families with church offices in the Papal States. And so he's involved in a knockdown, drag-out struggle for political control over the area that he's supposed to be able to govern. At the same time, he's also in a knockdown, drag-out economic and political struggle with the French king. Because basically what the French king wants is more money from the church and more control of the church by his own office, and therefore taking away some power from the Pope. And so Boniface is involved in two major political struggles, one in central Italy and one we would say international. And what's important to see is Boniface, who was himself a canon lawyer by trade, and very old when he became Pope, was almost totally consumed during his 9-year pontificate in these two separate, although occasionally they overlap, these two separate political campaigns, one largely of paper and propaganda, the other sometimes of swords and spears.
Now, we mentioned that all this is going to be necessary for us because the cast of characters, Boniface himself, Frederick the Holy Roman Emperor, a great many other people who were directly and indirectly involved in first the Guelph-Ghibelline struggle and then the White-Black struggle, are going to be seen in the Commedia. But of course, in fact, the most important person that this struggle affects is Dante himself. Because once the Pope backs the Black Guelphs, right, then Dante, a White Guelph, is doomed. That is to say, Boniface's decision to support the Black Guelphs and send his troops to expel the Whites was the direct cause of Dante's own exile. And as we mentioned at the beginning, Dante's exile is one of the most important things that we need to consider as a kind of condition for writing the poem, but also the issues of his exile, the issues of this whole struggle. This issue on a local level and this issue on a national level and this international level, all of this becomes part of the subject of the poem itself.
we need, therefore, to sort of stop for a second and say, just sort of flat out, that this is a poem of exile. It is unimaginable that Dante would have written something sort of just a little bit different had he remained sort of fat and comfortable in Florence for the rest of his life. It is permeated with the theme of exile, from Dante's statement at the very beginning about being lost in a dark wood of error, through various characters he meets who, in fact, tell us different ways that they dealt with political rejection and exile, to some of the great theological issues he raises that are perhaps challenging to him because of his situation as an exile. At every level of reading this poem, it is a work of exile.
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to think about this to add to what Bill has said. First of all, it's highly unlikely that the poem would ever be written without the exile, simply because it provides subject matter. Okay, but there's another way to look at it as well, because it seems that what happens is that in the early years of Dante's exile, what he was mostly concerned with was thinking about ways that he could possibly get back, okay, sort of making alliances and assuming that this was just a kind of a temporary situation, since there always had been this fluctuation that, okay, yeah, the blacks are in power now, but if we hang around for a while, we'll be able to get back. That didn't happen. All right, and it seems like at a certain point in the exile, Dante really turned his attention elsewhere. That is to say, instead of trying to figure out the best way of getting back from exile, he began to think about the larger meaning of exile. And to do this, it was not just simply sort of pondering the state of the universe in a vacuum. Dante, or so it seems,